It is an honor and a privilege to call Achille Mbembe a colleague and a friend. He is an extraordinary intellectual, and he is one of Africa's finest sons. And on this beautiful day, beautiful and sunny day in Johannesburg, we are having a conversation, and I thought we could start with one of your controversial concepts. What does it feel like in 2025 to be an Afropolitan, or 2024? What does it feel like to be an Afropolitan?
Just like Lonipa, I am very, very happy to sit here and have this conversation with you, not only as a colleague but also as a friend and as somebody for whom I have a lot of affection. Now you're asking me what it feels like to be an Afropolitan on this day in Johannesburg in South Africa. How can I say this? For me, it means first of all being in a city that has been like the cradle of African industrialization, at least since the late part of the 19th century. It means being in a place that is, in fact, a meeting place of many, many nations or nationalities, a place which whose potential is immeasurable, both in terms of the wealth that is beneath the soil on which we stand, and the wealth that is carried by the quality of the people who inhabit this place, and therefore the kind of promise of total emancipation I think Johannesburg has been in the South African history and in the history of this part of our world. So for me, Afropolitanism, that's what it says, our presence in the world, and the potential we have of shaping it partly in our own image, but also in full openness to, let's say, the rest of humanity. That's what Afropolitanism means for me.
And let's go back a little bit to a story that you told me about your father. This is also part, I guess, of the Afropolitan story, because your father was a medical doctor, correct?
He was a lawyer, rather. But law is more or less the same thing as medicine. If I have to. My father was a very quiet man. And he hardly spoke. So people were always seeking for his advice because they had this feeling that whenever he said something, it was really important and it had to be followed. But he had also a huge interest in agriculture. In fact, he owned a farm 60 kilometers from the capital city, Yaoundé, where I was born. And he was very much involved in collective, let's say, setting up of structures of community development in his village. Part an intellectual, part a lawyer, part a wise person, and part a peasant, did shape a lot of my own understanding of our relationship with the soil, with the ancestors, with a community of which we are part of. And I grew up in that kind of communal environment until I left.
Right. The reason why I was remembering your father is because I think you told me a story that he never used to allow you to eat sugar.
Yes.
And that once...
That's true.
Yes. So that's the story that I was actually aiming for. That you as a small child, you had to steal sugar. You were not allowed to eat sugar.
No, I wasn't. I mean, I was not alone to be forbidden to eat sugar. Right. All of us.
Yeah.
But it happened that I was tempted.
Right.
The level of temptation on my side was really very high compared to my sisters, who didn't seem to have a problem with the taboo. So one day my father, he went somewhere after breakfast and he forgot a bottle of full of sugar inside.
Right.
And at some point I was playing and I came, stopped by, I saw it and I thought, maybe if I eat one piece of sugar, he won't notice. So I came, ate one, went back, and soon I was back, picked up another one. I kept coming back, and at some point, I mean, the level of the sugar went down, of course.
Right.
I tried to replace the pieces of sugar to give the illusion that they were at the level where he left them. But of course, I mean, these things doesn't work like that. So he came back and he noticed that the number of pieces of sugar had diminished. And he wanted to know who was responsible for this horrific act. And I had to confess immediately, because not confessing would have doubled my pain. And I was dutifully dealt with.
Right. So
in repentance for my sin.
Right. So
since then,
right,
my consumption of sugar went absolutely down.
Because it is linked to the next question that I'm going to ask you. Because at quite a young age, you were a devout Catholic. And at some point...
I wouldn't say devout, but yeah, we used to go to church.
Right.
We went to church every Sunday.
Right.
I still remember, I mean, in church then we were seated according to genders and age. Mm-hmm. So the younger people, between 5 and I would say 8, 9, were the first, boys sitting on the right and girls on the left. And in the church, I mean, of course, I went every Sunday with my cousins. And on the other side, I could see a really beautiful girl.
Yeah, right.
Who, at a very young age, did attract me a lot.
Right.
And I ended up asking one of my cousins, but who is this girl? What's her name? I was given the name, and I would see her every time we went to church.
Right.
But from afar.
Right.
It took me 17 years before I spoke to her for the first time.
But as part
so for 17 years,
you
I
were,
harbored
you exactly,
in my heart,
oh my God,
you know, a passion,
right,
a silent passion for this girl, whose name was Marie Thérèse.
Oh wow! Okay, and she had a religious.
No, I mean, we all went to church because that was the custom. But I have to tell you that I was never really pious.
Okay,
I always harbored, even as a young person, a kind of doubt,
right,
about what was going on.
Yeah.
But something was very striking for me as a young boy going to church. It was this image of Christ,
yeah,
on the cross. It always intrigued me.
Mm-hmm.
This human being nailed on the cross and undergoing what must have been a terrible form of torture.
Mm-hmm.
And at Easter, then we would go to through this rituals on Thursday, Holy Thursday, and then Holy Friday was really the worst moment, witnessing these, listening to the story of him going through the Calvary.
Mm-hmm.
And then Saturday, I think Saturday night, then he would come out of the of the grave and and a magnificent gesture of resurrection. And I think that Christianity for me became really an important aspect of my mental landscape. These dialectics of life and death, death and resurrection, and it has had an impact on my way of reading our history, the history of Africa.
And then when did the Jesuits come in? Because I also know that you were influenced a lot by Jesuits.
Yes, I was deeply influenced by the Jesuits. I went to a boarding school at age, I think, 12. I remember my father, you mentioned him, accompanying me to the train station to go to the boarding school for the first time. It was 300 kilometers from where I was born. And I had never really left home before that. And I can still remember today, you know, looking into his eyes as the train was leaving and seeing a kind of sadness in it, which never left me. But so every time I had to study, I thought about him putting me in the train. And he had given me a list with all the stations I would pass by before arriving to destination, and he had forgotten one of them. So when I didn't see it, I just panicked, and but things were restored properly after that. So the Jesuits, I went to a school where they were, I mean, the teachers. It's thanks to them that I was initiated into the classics, Latin, Greek, kind of ethics of learning, which became part and parcel of who eventually I ended up becoming.
And do you want to be specific about what ways do you think that classical education influenced the way you think, the way you've thought about Africa's predicaments, the way you've thought about post-colonialism? Do you want to draw a thicker line between the two things?
In fact, now that you ask, I think I was shaped by a diversity of intellectual currents. I didn't tell you about my grandmother, whose name was Susanna. My grandmother used to come and stay with us, and she had been she had participated in the anti-colonial struggle, which took place in Cameroon in the 50s. She went underground. She was a fighter in the liberation movement, and the peculiarity of Cameroon was that this anti-colonial movement aiming at the decolonization of Cameroon was heavily defeated militarily by the French, who then put in power. In fact, those from Cameroon who had fought against the very idea of independence, which tells you something about French colonialism. And my grandmother, her own son, was also a member of this anti-colonial movement, and he was killed by the French on September 13, 1958, with the leader of the movement, whose name was Reuben. So my grandmother would come to us. I was born later. And every time she came to us, she would start telling us young people the story of that period of time, the songs. And so she influenced me a lot because I could see the injustice in that the way in which that history unfolded. And injustice in the ways in which those who fought for freedom were mistreated by the post-colonial state, to the point where it was forbidden to even pronounce the name of Ruben Umnyobe, the leader of that struggle, long after he had been assassinated. So that, I think that's the reason why later on I studied history. And in fact, my own dissertation, the key topic was about that period of the history of Cameroon. Then my grandmother was also a diviner. She was a healer. She had a very good understanding of plants, local plants, and about their therapeutic properties. And she could also see, we say, see in the night, meaning tell you about what would be happening to you using indigenous forms of knowledge. And she was a very beautiful person. So I used to spend a lot of time with her. So that was probably a very formative experience for me, this embeddedness in the world of ours, with all its many anthropological divisions, the world of the night, the world of the day, the communication with occult forces, with ancestors, for instance, that you can speak to them, you can speak to the dead, you can foresee what's going on, you can sing and listen to the echo and the speech of the environment, of trees, plants, or even the wind. So I was very shaped by that environment. So the Greeks and the Jesuits basically and came a bit later, and the church and its rituals. So what did you want me to tell you about the Jesuits?
Yes, just about your... I mean, we can combine the two things, actually, talking a little bit about that boarding school. I mean, I went to boarding school, and I know that boarding schools change everything from the way you eat to the people who are your friends, the way you dress, all of that. And then, and then obviously, this intellectual isolation. Because one of the things about boarding schools is that they are very intellectually intense. You know, you can find yourself basically spending nearly every afternoon in the library with a book, and even forget that there's a world out there, even forget that you have a family, even like you remember, oh, it's the end of term, I need to pack and go back home. But you've been so involved in it. And then after that, then having to travel to the metropole, to France for your university education.
Oh, definitely. But I mean, our boarding school was operating along similar principles. We had to wake up at around 5 in the morning. Undergo the spiritual exercises, meditation, deal with your bed, and a whole structure of discipline which really followed you on a daily basis with a series of rituals throughout the day, all of which had at their apex the business of learning. Learning meaning, on the one hand, an intimate contact with books that you had to read and read carefully. Learning having at its apex too the capacity to listen to the teacher who is opening up to you an entire world. I was totally amazed, for instance, in my Latin lessons by what I was discovering, reading old Greek mythologies, African literature, because we were independent, and then they were trying to shape a new African person who was able to draw its strengths from as many heritages as possible. So we were reading our authors, Mongo Beti, Ferdinand Oyono, Wole Soyinka, most of them, of course, Senghor's poetry, etc. So it was a monastic kind of time, pretty ascetic, mm-hmm. where we were taught to have our eyes transfixed on the essential, on what really mattered. And of course, it meant many other things didn't. For instance, I mean, money, wealth. I was taught all along that it didn't matter. And by the way, I mean, I don't own anything as we speak. Mm. I don't own a house. I don't own a car. But I own lots of books. Mm-hmm. So books became like, not friends, but really that which you cannot part ways with. Mm-hmm. Just like a family. So we have a big, books are like a big family. Mm-hmm. And then you have cousins, you have brothers, sisters, grandparents. Books are my family.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. So I'll tell you a little bit about one of the things that happened to me when I was in boarding school. My grandfather died and my family didn't tell me. They waited for me until the end of term. For a long time, I was so angry that how could you not tell me? And they would look at me like, yeah, but you were in boarding school. And to them, it was completely logical that mm-hmm. when you are in boarding school, yes. everything that happens at home is it's none of your...
Yes.
Yeah, you
yes.
just you cope with it when you yes. come out. Like, they were like, what would you have done? Because it's not like you
yes,
were going to...
Yes, wouldn't have done anything.
Exactly.
Except, I mean, being there
exactly.
and sharing the grief.
Right.
But it was the same thing in Cameroon. I mean, you are sent... I come from a family of seven children, my brother and then my five sisters. And then I was picked somewhat to be sent to the boarding school. Mm-hmm. All the others went to public schools.
Right.
But it's like you are given to the world.
Right.
And then you still belong, but you belong to more than just the mm-hmm. The family.
Right.
I grew up in that kind of context.
Right. And you mentioned the fact that part of this education was about creating the new African.
Yes.
What do you think has happened to that project of the new
you
African?
You see, it worked for some time. Mm-hmm. It worked for the first, 24 years of my life. I could see it. I mean, my parents belonged to a generation which had presided to the last years of colonial order and who understood themselves as invested with the mission of building a new nation, mm-hmm. an African nation. And they really took it seriously, now that I look into that. So, for instance, every year, although this was a very authoritarian government, the government could tell you, you know what, this year we have built 122 schools. We have built 30 hospitals. We have built 100 kilometers of tarred roads. We have built 3 airports. They could give you an account of how national resources have been spent in pursuit of national development. Things were it was not a rich country, not at all, but it was working. You could see progress. Mm-hmm. You could measure it, and you could benefit from it. I mean, when I went to the university, the first years of my university, I was paid to go to the university. Mm-hmm. And this was not exceptional. Everybody who went to the university was given a bursary in order to study. They would send thousands of students abroad. to specialize in a number of areas which were needed for Cameroon's development. And they invested a lot in education. But something went wrong somewhere. It just derailed, I think, from the 80s on. And things became really bad. Indebtedness soon followed by corruption, predatory behavior, and many people left. And as I speak, they are still living. I left not because of all of that, but because I wanted to pursue my studies in Europe.
Right. And did you find the transition that suddenly, I guess, identifying with the French-speaking world, the French-speaking diaspora, the French-speaking Caribbean, did you suddenly think of yourself as part of this larger culture?
You see, before I arrived in Paris in the early 80s, I think at a moment when France itself was undergoing a transition from long years of conservatism to socialism, Mitterrand had just been elected. But I mean, where I came from, we had some kind of familiarity with, in any case, in the intellectual literary field, with French culture. We spoke French, for instance. We studied in French. We were reading more or less the same thing as our peers in France. I knew their history. I had been groomed into it all along. So when I arrived in Paris in the early 80s, I don't feel really like a foreigner, except by the fact that I'm not a French citizen. All of those who went abroad then, in those years, 1960, 70, 80, always had as their final project to go back. Because we grew up with this idea that we had a nation to build. So we go, we learn, and we go back. We go home. So I didn't find anything strange. But of course, Paris being what Paris is, it's a larger world. You meet more people, you read more authors. I attended many seminars where I learned a lot. I was not a very good student in the sense that I tended to just read voraciously and not focus on on what was asked from me or for my immediate, let's see, homework or whatever. So I learned a lot.
That image of you, you, I think, also told me that when you were living in the U.S., you also did exactly the same thing, that your almost your entire bedroom was covered with
books. I would sleep with books around me. I felt really so comfortable and protected, surrounded by Heidegger, Hegel, and I mean all those people who would read up to 2 or 3 in the morning.
Right.
Because when I moved to the U.S., I moved to New York first, and then I went to Philadelphia to teach. I spent so much time in the library at Columbia University, where you have been.
Exactly.
Butler Library. I was, every week I would go. At the time, I don't know how things are these days. So you go into the library. On the left, there was a periodical room where you had all the latest issues of almost every journal in the social sciences and the humanities. And I would take an afternoon, go journal by journal to see what was new. And whatever was new and I was interested in, I would pick up, Xerox, and go and read from home. So I spent a lot of time at Butler's Library. I have stories about Butler's Library. One day, I didn't hear the bell ring, So they locked me up in the library. That's hard to, ring the alarm bell.
Right, right.
They came thinking there was fire or something. No, no, no.
Yeah,
it was just me. I was busy and I forgot.
You forgot
to exit.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank God they didn't punish me.
So
I thought they would give me a heavy fine.
Right.
For having mobilized all.
Yes,
all of
exactly,
that,
exactly. Yes. Yeah, for a false alarm.
Yes,
yeah.
For a false alarm indeed.
Yes, exactly.
Because in fact, yes, there was an indication there.
Yeah.
That if you triggered a false alarm.
Yeah.
You were liable to a fine.
Right, right,
but I escaped,
you escaped
both punishment and the fine.
And so I'm gonna fast forward from the American experience. I mean, you can say if you want to add.
But so I was living in Paris. I mean,
right.
For many years, I was almost a Parisian, although, in fact, a huge part of my mind was still in Cameroon. So. I then got a job at Columbia University, so I moved from Paris to New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much of a shock. I had never imagined that I would end up in the United States of America. It was not part of my, in my generation, the dream, if you have a dream, dreams to go to Paris, and then you go home.
Mm-hmm.
But America was, out of her. Nobody thought that anything intellectually serious was happening there. So
right.
I ended up having a job there as an assistant professor in history. And I arrived in New York in September 1988, I think. And it's very different from Paris, of course. New York was then really just getting out of a period of crisis, where the university is, I was living there, full of vagrants, and it was just terrible, terrible in the sense that it was not nice to see. But immediately I immersed myself in a new place, so I started reading a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Thought I had to read a lot about African-American history, because for the first time I was living in the middle of that that place. I remember that I went to a bookstore. The first book I ever bought was W.E.B. Du Bois, his big book on Black Reconstruction. Of course, I didn't try to read it, but I didn't really understand. You need a background to understand that.
Right.
And then I read a lot since I was in New York about Jewish history and Jewish thought. And I had a rabbi on my floor in the university, Center of African Studies, with whom I crafted a long conversation and who introduced me a lot to Jewish theologians, and Hermann Cohen, Franz Rosenzweig, Martin Buber. I spent years studying them.
And that also, was it a more spiritual education or was it a more kind of intellectual education?
It was both. It was both intellectual and spiritual. I was reading both Jewish theologians and African American theologians, Cohen, Martin Luther King himself, all the work done by the Black Church. You remember? I mean, Columbia is next to Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to Harlem, and in fact, it's in Harlem that I went. I saw for the first time Fela Anikulapo Kuti. He came for a performance at the Apollo Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I was opened up to this really entirely new world. There was almost every representative of every single nation on earth in New York, beginning with the university. If you wanted to learn something about Latin America, you could go to a seminar on Latin America. Asia, the same thing, an amazing tapestry, intellectual tapestry, which really I think I benefited a lot from it. And it helped me to reassess my own origins and, let's say, our own historical trajectory in this continent.
And did that influence, I guess, the way you would think, for example, about your the book that I think has become one of your classic books, classic arguments, a classic Mbembe argument on the post-colony. After having seen the world from the perspective of Cameroon, the perspective of the French capital, as it were, and then you are now in this diaspora in the United States, do you think that that's when those ideas started germinating in your mind?
I think so. I think that by the time I really arrived in America, or in any case, shortly after I have arrived there, and as I begin to immerse myself in this multiplicity of worlds, I start, let me put it this way, speaking in tongues. So on the post-colony is a bit like that.
Right,
it doesn't belong to any discipline. It's really a kind of moment of any revelation, not at all, but a moment of liberation of the speech, of language. Because Africa was so deeply invented in language, not our own language, but the language of another. So the point then is, how does one breaks the chains of somebody else's language in order to be able not to speak in a pure tongue, but in a tongue that carries the traces of the many other tongues his or her own has been in touch with. On the post-colony is something like that. It's a big book of rebellion, and there are no profanities in the book, but the book itself is an act of profanation against a number of idols that constituted what people were expecting an African intellectual to see and how to see it.
And I mean, at that time it must have been hard, you know. I mean, you and I share that experience of being on this treadmill that's called the tenure track.
Oh, you see.
Yeah.
I never really thought about it. I was totally oblivious. You see, my life has been maybe very naive.
Right.
In the sense that, as I told you, I don't own anything.
Yes.
I don't expect much.
Right.
I just try to do what really gives me passion.
Right.
And I try to do it to the best of my possibilities. So when I read as deeply as I can. So I was never really interested in having a career, meaning attending to questions of tenure and all of that. I remember, I mean, the third year at Columbia, then I got an offer from UPenn. So I can tell you all of this. I mean, when I first arrived at Columbia, an assistant professor, we earned $30,000 a year. And then they would add a little bit every year. So by the third year, I think I was earning something like $35,000. So I get an offer from UPenn, and they tell me, oh, you know what, we will give you an associate professorship, and then we'll raise your salary to $40,000. I said, okay, I mean, look. So I go to see my head of the department. I said, look what I got from UPenn. He said, don't worry about it. I will give you exactly the same thing.
Right.
So I went back to my business. And then 10 days later, UPenn calls me, but have you seen our offer?
Mm-hmm.
I say, yes. So what's your response? I say, oh, by the way, I'm sorry I didn't write back, but my head of department just told me that they would give me the same thing,
mm-hmm.
and I don't have any reason whatsoever to come to UPenn. I said, okay, don't worry, we'll send you a new offer. So they sent a new offer less than a week later, when they, this time, they raised the salary, I mean, substantially,
right.
Meaning 50,000 a year.
Right.
With the same associate professorship. So I went back to the head of the department, said, but look now, look at what they have sent.
Right.
And then he told me, oh, let me think about this. Come back in 2 days. 2 days later, I went back and he told me, no, Ashil, you know, we like you really very much. You are so important for us here. But, you know, I cannot match the salary. Because if I do so, there are people here in the department who have been here longer than you and who earn less
mm-hmm.
than what UPenn is offering. So I don't think I can do this in good conscience.
Right.
So either you stay with us or, look, if you don't like it, you go. So I left.
At least you had chips to bargain
yes,
with.
Yes, somewhat, but I wasn't really interested in all of that.
Right.
I left, and so when I'm writing on the post-colony, it's not really to have tenure.
Right.
Because somewhere, I always thought that I was there temporarily.
Right.
That I would go back.
Right.
And I didn't need any of that.
Right.
All I needed were my books.
Right. Yes, yeah. Well, I sometimes say to people, academics, we're like drug addicts.
Yes.
We'll do anything for our fix. We'll take any job as long as it involves a book budget.
Yes.
As long as you have money to buy books.
As long as you have money. I think that I have spent, I don't know how much money I have earned in my life, not much. But the little I have earned, I think 3/5 of it has gone to books.
To books, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
At some point, to music too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's for some reason I have stopped listening to buying music as such since these days. I mean, you get somewhat for free.
Right. Yes. And let's continue that.
But what I forgot was how heavy books are. Because if you really want to run away,
right,
that the danger has arrived, and then you have to run away, you have to pick up.
Yes, you have to. Yeah.
A few things.
Exactly.
Then you are in trouble with books.
Right. Yes. No. Definitely not something that you want to.
Not at all.
Yeah, but luckily the books are replaceable.
That's the thing.
Right.
So my love has always been with books.
Right. No, I understand that completely. I share the same. Yeah. Sometimes you don't read them. You just buy them.
Yes, you buy some. I mean, I try to have at least read the introduction.
Right.
Because of the fear that someday somebody will come to my office or my library and say, okay, what is he saying, this author?
Right.
And then I won't be able to say.
Yeah.
I have to be able to say, okay, at least this is the problem he's trying to solve.
Right. And how would you respond then if someone said to you, Ashil Mbembe, you've never written a book that is understandable to the man in the street? So yes, transgressive, groundbreaking, but why does the man in the street?
No, because I can't talk to the man or the woman on the street the way I speak when I write books.
Mm-hmm.
I have to speak to them in an entirely different language, which they are somewhat familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So I will use other mechanisms, which I have done, in fact, throughout all my life. I have intervened a lot in public life
mm-hmm.
Through other means, through radio, for instance, interviews in the newspapers, through direct participation to actual social organizations and movements. So there's a huge part of my work which is in that field.
Mm-hmm.
And with the development of new technologies, I mean, you go to YouTube, have been a kind of dissemination of thought which has proceeded along those ways.
Mm-hmm.
The books have been somewhat, yes, I mean, I've been using some kind of technical language, just like a doctor.
Right.
I mean, he doesn't speak like you and I, or an atomic engineer. So there are a few things there which require some technicity.
Mm-hmm.
So these are different languages. The the issue is to be able to convert one language into the other.
Mm.
If one really wants to speak to different publics,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think so. I mean, you do that every time,
right?
In your own work.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, I hope to also one day be called transgressive in the way that you. I think I pick more antiquarian topics than you. But
yeah, because I grew up in a big household. I mean, you tease people all the time.
Right.
Kind of restlessness.
Yes.
I think that I carried it with me in my own academic work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And I think that's a very important thing to say, because I think sometimes people think your personal identity is separate from your voice as an intellectual.
No. I mean, not that I love scandals. No, not at all. But a little bit of excitement and shaking people.
Yeah.
I've been shaking oneself too.
Yeah, like a little bit of a breeze, bracing.
If not, we just fall asleep, I mean.
Exactly. before we run out of time, I'd like to talk a little bit about what I found fascinating over the last couple of years that you started working on, and that is revisiting Frantz Fanon.
Oh.
And Frantz Fanon's ideas. What does it look like at the moment? What does it mean to sort of reread Fanon in the 21st century?
You see, On the Postcolony was a dialogue with Fanon, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
The Fanon of the wretched of the earth, when he is trying to put his finger onto what decolonization means.
Mm-hmm.
And before decolonization, what colonialism is all about, which has been a key dimension of the work of our people over time, whether one talks about Aimé Césaire and his discourse on colonialism or many others,
mm-hmm.
George Padmore, how the British rule Africa, or for that matter, the experience in African American thought, in the context in which, for instance, Du Bois and others reflect on the deep nexus which exists between liberal democracy and necropolitics, or for that matter, those who have worked on the concept of the internal colony. What does it mean to be under the rule of somebody else? And what does it mean to emerge out of the shadows of that form of tyranny? So On the Postcolony was somewhat an attempt at pursuing the Fanonian intuitions, in this case, in the context of what happens after colonialism. Mm-hmm. So Fanon has been with me for a long time. But I was also interested in Fanon because of the fact that he was a healer. Maybe in memory of my grandmother. He was a doctor. He was somebody whose function was to try to heal people. And he understood disease as being caused fundamentally by the inability to make community. To live in common, this question of commonality, commonness, or the in common. So if you want, these have been two faces of my own work. The question of how we sit and summon all the courage to look into the tragedy of our history, in order to retrieve it from meaninglessness, to give it meaning to people suffering over a long period of time. Most of the times, for no obvious reason. So how do we make sure that this is just not a total waste? It means nothing. It means it can go on forever. How do we give meaning to this experience? And the attendant experience of becoming a full person, both for humans and non-humans. So that has been at the center. Fanon, those are the questions he's asking. And I wanted to look into his pharmacy to see, you know, what are the les médicaments, what medicine is it that he is proposing? And that's how I discovered the importance of breathing in Fanon, of which he speaks constantly. A term which has acquired such an importance of late with what we see in the U.S., but also with COVID and the rest, a politics of breathing, a universal right to breathe as a part of what it means precisely to be alive and to be fully human. But there have been many other interlocutors. I mean, Baldwin, whom I haven't been citing a lot, but who has been there because very interesting sensibility. Toni Morrison and her ways of writing, the kind of depth she brings to bear onto our history and the way we interpret it. Or the likes of Edouard Glissant, who has helped to think the whole question of worldliness and the importance of the earth as the basis for a community, the earthly community, as I write in the last book I have just published. So there have been a number of interlocutors like that. But I have to say, now that we are moving towards the end, that of course I've spent my life moving from one place to the other, you know, circling around the Atlantic Triangle, born in Cameroon, then Paris, and then New York, and then back to Africa. But I have to say that my location in South Africa over the last 23 years has been absolutely key to whatever it is that I have thought or I have written. I have spent in South Africa the biggest part of my life as an adult. And I have written most of my major books from, in fact, this office, from South Africa, in Johannesburg. And South Africa has been a deep template from which I have tried to read the world.
Mm.
And because I believe that something is peculiar to this place, which doesn't mean that it's not comparable to others, but something, there's something peculiar here. And there's something that has happened here, the meaning of which we have not finished deciphering. Something happened here in the 90s, which we is still interpolating us, and it seems to me that the work of interpreting the history of this place is far from over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very sad that this conversation has to end. But before we end it, I often like to recommend books to people. So when people ask me and they say, well, you know, which book should I read? And I often think, well, you know, I have a list of books you should read before you die. That's what I normally say to people. So if you had to, let's say you are talking to a young child who is curious and is thinking, you know, when I grow up, I want to be Achille Mbembe. You know, what books, just maybe five, that you would say are so powerful, are so profound, are so mind-changing, that you would say to, you know, a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old child, whatever you do, you have to read these books?
Oh, I know the first one, yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Look, maybe the child would have to wait a little bit, but before he or she dies, he or she should definitely read this one. It's a book by a Nigerian author whose name is Amos Tutuola.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the title comes to me in French, Livron dans la brousse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I really can't remember how to translate this in English.
Mm-hmm.
But Amos Tutuola is the first author I would advise to read.
Mm-hmm.
He is a Yoruba author, a man who was not really, he didn't go to university, or he was a postman. He was working in the post office, and aside from his work in the post, he was writing basically about Yoruba mythologies. But it's My Life in the Bush of the Ghost, I think that's the title,
mm-hmm.
is an amazing piece of work,
mm-hmm.
and piece of imagination. It's really a big hymn on freedom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a very postmodern piece of writing in the guise of traditionalism.
Mm-hmm.
It fits perfectly well with the kind of technological age we live in. You read it and you think, oh, in fact, Africans were dealing with algorithms long before algorithms were given that name. So that's the first book,
mm-hmm.
For anybody, African and non-African, who really wants to, you know, go deep into the question of African metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
Or forms of animism, and the ways in which, in fact, in an age of combustion, the kind of impending ecological catastrophe we are witnessing, when we are asking questions about our own durability and the sustainability of life on Earth, for anyone who is looking for other sources or archives to respond to such key existential challenges of the now, go and read Tutuola.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tutuola would be enough.
Right.
Because from there, then, you can open up a number of other other spaces and avenues. But Tutuola is the book that comes to my mind as a, let's say, a foundational one.
Okay, so just one.
Just one.
Okay.
Because everything is in that one book.
And it's specifically this question of what you call this African metaphysics.
Yes.
I like that phrase that you use. And I'd like us to conclude on that. Do you want to say more about how that idea, this bringing together this African sensibility on what it means to be a being, not just a human being, but if we take out the human part and to be a being, and not just a being, but a being that when you're walking, you are being seen by other beings, you are being observed by other beings, and then you come into contact with other beings. There's something there that in Africa is a unique a sort of expression of what that means.
Yes, I do believe that, in fact, part of the future of the planet is being played out here. That just as Africa is the eldest daughter of the Earth, that the human somewhat was born here. Just as we enter, we go deep into this century, Africa will epitomize what is new in the world, if only because of its the kind of demographic revolution that is happening, that we are the oldest continent on Earth and the youngest. And that therefore we are a reserve of power and a power in reserve, both at the same time. And because of our capacity for resilience over centuries, there must be something in our deep archives which speaks to some of the key challenges of our time. And therefore, it becomes absolutely important to engineer that African moment. In the humanities, in the social sciences, in modes of organization of life. Why is it important to engineer these African moments and to revisit the depth of our archives? Because at the deep end of those archives, we'll find new propositions about the symbiotic nature of life, which is absolutely appropriate for the kinds of multi-crisis we are undergoing now. So maybe we can end it there with a call, a universal call, to come back to Africa as a place that is open to not only, as you were putting it, humans, but the entirety of living beings. In any case, that's the kind of intellectual effort I have been involved in as I read it ex post.
It's been an absolute mind-blowing, moving experience to spend the afternoon chatting to Achille Mbembe. And as I say, the intellectual extraordinaire, child of Africa, son of Africa. Thank you so much for giving me your time and for giving the listeners who are going to be listening to this interview your best work, your best ideas, and for sharing this moment with them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lonipa. Thanks a lot.